FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is April 12th, 2017. It's Wednesday. And as you probably are aware, Judge Neil Gorsuch has been confirmed as Supreme Court judge or justice, whatever you prefer. And it was done by means of elimination of the filibuster requiring 60 votes. He was pretty much brought in, I guess, on 54 votes in the Senate. And Professor Alan Saunders is with us now. You know him well. He's been on the show a number of times. Former Time Magazine reporter. Alan, you're now teaching political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, a place where I spent quite a bit of time in my youth. And we welcome you back to the show.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
So what do you think the significance is of the so-called nuclear option being deployed here?
Well, I think what we're seeing is probably the long-term and slow death of the Senate filibuster. Many people think that the filibuster was a constitutional requirement. It's something that the Senate needs and has done and must continue to have done going into the future. But the reality is that it's not constitutional. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that a filibuster must be had. It really started out as a kind of a custom, a kind of way of doing business in the Senate. The Senate, as it started out early in the country, was a small body, a small group of people, and there wasn't all that much business, federal business to handle. And so the custom arose that the senators should just have the ability to speak as long as they wanted to speak about an issue, and that it would lead to a proper airing out of ideas and lead to wiser policies. As it has developed and as the Senate has gotten bigger and larger, the filibuster did not evolve into a measure to discuss and to air out things. It actually became an obstructionist procedure by whoever was in the minority, whoever was the minority party. And so instead of engaging in debate, what it actually meant is that we would need to come up with 60 votes in order for a measure, whether it be an appointment or whether it be a legislative measure, to move forward. People didn't have to actually debate it. They just needed to come up with 60 votes because that's what you need to shut down a debate. So all you needed to do is to threaten a filibuster. Then they would take an immediate vote to see whether there were 60 votes to shut down the possible filibuster. And of course, that's almost impossible to get. And so they would just simply drop the measure or the appointment. So it evolved from being a sort of gentleman's kind of agreement to discuss things. And it evolved into really an obstructionist procedure.
So it sounds like you're in favor of its erosion in this case, because we still have it. We still have the filibuster in place as far as regular legislation goes. But
sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you'll find that there are many political scientists who believe that the filibuster is really an anachronism and an unnecessary one. Elections are meant to have results. One party wins, the other party loses. It goes back and forth over time. And it seems that the electorate needs to see that the institution is responding to whoever is in the majority. So while on individual matters, one may agree or disagree with the Senate doing something or not doing something, it seems to me that overall, over the passage of time, an obstructionist procedure such as this really stands in the way of the voters. And so you'll find many political scientists like me who believe that it's no great loss, and it's only a matter of time before all aspects of the filibuster are eliminated.
So what does it do to the long-term effectiveness or viability, if you will, of the Senate?
Well, there are two ways this can go, and you'll get different opinions on this. One is that it will allow the Senate to become more partisan and vote along partisan lines and result, at least in the context of the Supreme Court, in a more partisan Supreme Court. That's one possible path. The other possible path is that the majority party will realize that it's actually ruling and that it will be judged on the basis of what it does. With a filibuster and with so many obstructionist ways in which the filibuster can be used, it's hard to know who is really responsible for anything sometimes. But when you have a clear majority and you can get appointments confirmed or legislation passed, and it's clear that you have the majority, you are the majority party, then you're more responsible. And so it's actually possible that instead of having more partisanship come out of this, actually there might be some more moderation because you realize that you might be electorally accountable.
Yeah, because a lot of times bills would get proposed, legislation would get taken up in the Senate that the proponents of it knew had little or no chance of garnering the 60 votes. So it became kind of a grandstanding, showboating type chamber rather than a chamber that was dedicated to getting things done.
That's right. And, you know, in terms of, you know, many people say that the filibuster, you know, serves minority rights and all that. Well, there are many ways that a minority can assert its rights. It can certainly debate the issue. It can certainly air out the issue. One might consider that maybe the Senate might adopt a sort of modified filibuster, something to the effect that, okay, you can actually debate something, let's say, for a week to air it out and to bring forth whatever objections you might have. But after a week, then without having to come up with a supermajority of 60 votes, you actually get to vote on the issue. So there are many ways in which you can air out issues without using a totally obstructionist technique, like having to come up with 60 votes in order to go forward. So if the Senate were really serious about this, it could come up with what I guess you could call a modified filibuster, a limited, maybe week-long period of debate, and then go to an actual vote. But of course, you know, we do get caught up in these partisan issues, the issues of the moment. So there are all kinds of apocalyptic predictions. But I don't think that it's really likely to be the result. Yes, it might be more partisan. We might have a more partisan Senate. But as I say, we could just easily have a more responsible Senate.
And it's hard to envision it being more partisan than it already is, in fact, because it assures the minority the ability to torpedo any policy or any legislation that they don't approve of. It really draws a line in the sand and makes the whole thing more oppositional rather than collaborative, rather than saying, all right, they can pass this. Let's try to get our voices heard and get input into the legislation rather than just be obstructionist.
Well, I think that's right. And that would tend to be my view, that you might actually get some people who are now serious about doing something and doing something responsibly and having responsible measures and responsible nominees to the Supreme Court and to the cabinet departments, because now you're really on the hook. When you vote for something, you're actually really voting for it, as opposed to having sort of a symbolic vote that you know will make no difference because of the filibuster. So that's right. I think it makes for a more responsible government. And that's why I say many political scientists believe that it's no great loss.
Hey, and like you said, it's not written in stone in the Constitution, if you will. But when it started, it meant debate, like you said. But now it just means stop them dead in their tracks. So the concept of bringing debate back, that has to be a positive thing. If it's actually structured in such a way that it provides for debate on these controversial measures rather than just stop it dead in its tracks.
That's right. And there's great merit to having lengthy debates about the controversial issues, but those debates have to come to an end and a conclusion at some point so that the government can move forward. So while there is great merit to debate, even long debate about difficult questions that we face as a country, if you really want to have a functioning country, you need to be able to pass legislation of one kind or another. If you simply use it as an obstructionist technique, well, we have already plenty of obstructionist techniques in the checks and balances that are the constitutional checks and balances. Filibuster is not a constitutional check and balance. It's simply a rule of the Senate. But, you know, we have two chambers. Both chambers need to be able to pass a law. So you'll get a lot of airing out without a filibuster because it first needs to be discussed in the House, then in the Senate, or vice versa, first in the Senate and then in the House. And then, of course, the president weighs in and has the potential of having a veto. You mix into that the two-party system, and sometimes a party, as currently is the case, will have all three branches of government under its control, sometimes only one or two of the actual branches under its control. So there are many checks and balances. Sometimes they do check and balance, sometimes they don't, but over time, there are checks and balances, and it seems to me, and it seems to many other political scientists, that that's enough. You also need to have a functioning government. So while checks and balances are important, it is equally important to have a government who can actually, or which can actually, enact legislation and pursue programs and administer programs.
Yeah, of course. And like you say, it really forces the majority. You know, they don't have excuses now for not governing either, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a majority, as currently is the case now, you have the Republican majority in the House and the Senate, and the presidency is held by Republicans as well. Now the party is on the hook. Can it produce? Can it administer? Can it do things that it promised that it would do? And are the things that it promised that it would do actually beneficial for the country? People can now assess that. And that's an important part of a democracy. Part of a democratic benchmark is performance. Is the government performing in accordance with the people's wishes? Well, if you have, if you remove some, but not all, if you remove some of the checks and balances, a political check and balance here, the filibuster, then you get perhaps greater accountability and you can assess whether the government is in fact performing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, so it's one of those things where it's just kind of outlived its usefulness. And now that it's eroding, what's it going to take to get rid of it entirely?
Well, I mean, you know, there'll be a lot more debate about it. I think some of it will be a little bit experimental. That is to say, we'll see how it is operating with the elimination of the filibuster as it pertains to cabinet officers and judicial appointments. There'll be a little bit of testing about that. And then I suspect some forward-looking members of the Senate will say, well, it seems to be working, or at least it's not doing all the damage that we thought it would. And the politics of the moment will probably overtake the next debate over the filibuster, and whoever is in the majority and is feeling unable to do what it feels it ought to do or was elected to do, they'll look back on what was done here with nominees for the cabinet and for judicial appointments and say, well, let's carry it forward and let's move on. Particularly as we move into the 21st century, where it is going to be more than ever important for the government to be able to act ever more quickly as we move fully into the internet age and all of the other technologies that are associated with the internet. A lot of people will say, look, the Senate has to adapt. It can no longer be a debating society. Where you have two gigantic oceans separating the United States from other countries, those oceans don't separate the U.S. anymore. The internet world is much too complex, and so we need to develop procedures that are responsive to that. So I think you'll see both looking backwards, and I think you'll also see some looking forwards, and ultimately I think the Senate will decide it's time to move on.
Right. So these predictions of all these dire consequences really overblown, in your opinion?
Well, I think so. Don't forget that the United States Senate has undergone a dramatic change. Many people forget that for the first half of U.S. history, senators were not elected. They were appointed by the state legislature. It took an amendment in 1913 to make senators elected by the people. Now, there were all kinds of dire predictions as to what that would do. My goodness, the states should have their representatives in the Senate. State legislatures should pick who is the senator. Now we're going to have the electorate pick senators and select senators. There was a lot of debate about that and about how that would change and forever damage the Senate. Of course, there were many people who believed that that was the right thing to do and a progressive and a democratic thing to do, but there was lots of opposition to it as well. And the Senate has survived. It's now elected by the people of the United States. It's a totally different institution than what the framers conceived it to be. By and large, it has served the people well. So changing the rules, changing the way in which the Senate operates has already been done in a very dramatic way. And it seems to me that the filibuster is yet another important way, but it's nowhere as dramatic as making the senators elected officials as opposed to appointed officials.
Yeah, that was a big deal that really from our vantage point in history, we don't really appreciate as much as we should, because basically the legislature of each state chose the senator. Or senators.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of backroom deals. It was a lot of political maneuvering. I guess you could you could really say there's states that elect their judges and there's states that appoint them. And we're kind of still having the battle now about keeping the politics out of it. But really, what's more political than picking some guy in a back room to represent the state?
Well, that's right. And, it upset the existing order. And so many people didn't want that to happen, but also many other people. And of course, we got an amendment that changed the rules and said they should be elected. That's the more democratic way to have representatives argue the policies of the country in the Senate. So we've done this. It was very dramatic. It seems to me that eliminating the filibuster is another change, but another change that will render the institution, again, more democratic than it is right now.
Yeah. So you think putting limitations on it's probably the next logical step, like you said, saying a week of unlimited debate and then and then it's over, kind of something like that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, legislators and legislatures typically always act through compromise. It's a rare day that you get sort of a very clean decision from a legislature because you're dealing with members that represent very divergent interests. So my guess is when it is eliminated, there probably will be some retention of some element of debate that needs to be guaranteed so that the minority has its say and its ability to state its views, you know, whether it's a week or whether it's another procedural technique remains to be seen. But legislatures always act on the basis of compromise. And that's something we always forget, that's the nature of a legislature. So I would be inclined to think, sure, there would be some middle ground that would be legislated and made the rule for the Senate. But of course, we'll have to wait and see. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But I think many people believe that eventually it's going to go and be replaced by something more democratic.
Yeah. And somehow, like other changes, and there's been lots of changes in society that are much more revolutionary than that, somehow we survive, we go on, and we continue. So maybe it's more of a less a substantive issue than one of form of procedure. And we've gotten lost in the procedure and lost sight of the substance effectively.
Yeah, I think so. I would second that view, surely.
Yeah. So basically, they're going to be like the House of Representatives. There's no filibuster there. The minority really has no protections. Everything's in the rulemaking committee in the House, and the whole manner in which the bills are debated all is according to the Rules Committee. Are you going to see something like that occur in the Senate as well?
Well, ultimately you might get there, but as I say, there probably will be some procedural protections for the minority because the Senate has operated for all these years with a filibuster. So I think it probably doesn't want to go and look exactly like the House. So I think there will be some mechanisms to slow things down so that the minority can slow things down. But I think ultimately there will be a push to get rid of the filibuster because institutions simply evolve. There's the necessity to get business done. And understand, to the extent that the Senate is unable to act as a result of the filibuster, what that also does, it has some impact on other aspects of the government. It means that the president then, because he cannot get his legislative agenda through the Senate, is looking and keeps looking for other ways to act administratively. So to the extent the Congress remains stymied and paralyzed, can't do anything, it encourages the president to act on his own and therefore increase the power, the authority of the presidency at the expense of Congress. Presidents are always adept at looking for loopholes in laws, loopholes in the constitutions, ways in which they can act administratively if Congress doesn't do its job. And that's been true of both Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents. So in other words, it serves the Congress to be a more efficient body. It disserves the Congress to be less efficient.
Agreed. And you make a great point that it effectively has shifted the balance of power more to the president because they'll say, well, he'll figure out a way to do it so we don't have to. We don't have to take the heat for it. And maybe we'll actually see the Congress reclaim much of the power that it's ceded away to the executive and to the legislative branch as well, I might add. And overall, a good thing. Hey, Professor Sanders, if we want to find your work, where's the best place to go?
Well, the best way to contact me and to see what I do is on the university website, St. Peter's University. Just Google St. Peter's University and you'll see all that we do here, and you will find me there as well.
Excellent. Hey, you've got any questions, comments, or feedback on this interview or any others that we do, please send me an email, kl@carrielutz.com, kl@carrielutz.com. Our Twitter feed's at Carrie Lutz, and our Facebook page is Financial Survival Network, and we will have a link to the professor's webpage over at the university. Hey, Professor, it's always great speaking with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's always my pleasure, Carrie. You have a great day.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.